So welcome back to the real world.
Thank you.
How was your vacation?
It was fine. It was pretty chill. Yearly family vacation with Jess's family, and it was about as hectic as, you know, you can expect for those levels of family interaction. It was fine.
It was fine.
Yeah.
Is it one of those, it was fine as you like stare off into the distance or was it fine?
It's like the dog sitting in the room that's on fire. This is fine.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I think I alluded to this before I left, but I was going to try to spend some downtime, just kind of like writing code and just trying stuff and playing with things. And, of course, it never really pans out as well as you hope it will, because it's just always stuff going on and whatever. But I did work on it a little bit. I can talk more about that later, but it was, good to be back. You know, I did listen to last week's episode just before this, just today, and I really enjoyed it. It's good to hear from Drew. I didn't know you guys had that whole long history. That was really cool to hear all the sort of parallels that you guys had.
Right. It's pretty, yeah. It seems to be happening more and more lately.
That's really cool. I had a little bit, well, every time he said junior developer, that like that phrase just really rubs me the wrong way. Like everyone's a junior developer at something, right? what does it even mean to be a junior developer? And to even take that title, I get that when you're applying for jobs or whatever, and for a particular position and particular set of tools, or technologies, or experience or whatever, you have to like put someone into a box and say like, this is the job you're applying for. But like, a junior developer is just a developer. Like, I don't know why there has to be this weird, I don't know. It seems like an artificial hierarchy, because it's not like one day you just graduate and become like a senior developer. It's not like you have a piece of paper on your wall.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's weird for me. I don't have a lot of real world experience with big companies and jobs and stuff, but you got to have a title, but man, I don't know.
Sure. It's really hard to, and this is, we've talked about this a lot too. Like, I don't feel like a CTO or don't feel like a senior dev or something like that. It's really hard to sort of like qualify that with, I don't know, concrete. This is a senior developer. This is a junior developer. I guess in my mind, sometimes I say developers that are more junior. I don't know, but I think like in my mind, there are some things that a person needs to have a grasp on to be productive or be able to be productive, able to learn, whether it's like in other languages or, you know, going from Ruby to Elixir or something similar, you know. And I think like there's certain concepts like learning how to use map, reduce, and filter, for example, right? Like learning, I don't know how else to explain it, but like the workhorse things, right? So if someone doesn't know how to effectively use map or filter, it might be more difficult for them to solve a problem than someone else that is familiar with map, reduce, and filter. And you know, certainly the person that's not familiar, they can re-implement those things themselves. But it's not as efficient and it's not the best solution, I guess. I don't know. I guess that's really mostly how I feel about it is it's really hard to sometimes like quantify what a junior developer is or what the different steps are. But I think there are just certain things, I don't know, like once you're familiar with them, you sort of graduate beyond having to have someone sort of follow you around and make sure things are working and helping you get unstuck. Maybe that's a bad way to say it, but that's how I can think about it right now.
I guess I could see that kind of delineation where you're working for someone. I'm using air quotes here, for someone, using someone as guidance, like for making those maybe higher level architectural decisions or how do I solve this or something. And I guess I could see it in that kind of respect.
Yeah, that's how I kind of see it. But I think like junior developer Twitter is a thing. And I've gone in there sometimes, and it seems like there's a lot of people that kind of call themselves junior developers and they tweet about being a junior developer and all that stuff. And that's cool. But I don't know that I would want them to get stuck to that, you know, because how do they know when they've advanced beyond that? When someone promotes them, you know, maybe that's not that's not maybe the best way to be able to qualify yourself as a junior developer or something, somebody more advanced than that.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think back, like I never actually had the title of junior developer officially, but I also don't feel like I'm a junior developer now. So like, okay, did it, was there like a phase somewhere where that happened? And I'm actually thinking about it. And yeah, there probably was when I was doing like summer internships, basically. Like I was doing Cold Fusion and .NET stuff for like a little ISP that like my mom knew, right? And like I did learn a lot of my web development chops there. So I guess that's kind of the role I was in there. I guess I could see that. Like I would definitely qualify. I would think of that as my identity at that point.
Right. But I mean, there's definitely something to your point about everyone's a junior developer in some respect. I mean, even more recently, I've been feeling much more like a junior developer with, for example, like I finally got Coherence out of DK and running through POW's code base. It handles a lot of stuff for you. And that's why friend of the show, Dan, is a really strong advocate now of, hey, don't build this yourself, because to do it right, to do it actually securely, there's a lot of considerations to be made here. And so I've always been of the mind, oh, I can just toss an auth token in there in the database and call it good. And then he started throwing me some more documentation on, I'll have to put it in the show notes now, but OWASP, I think, is the acronym for them. OWASP. But yeah, so he sent me their documents regarding like session handling, and I was like, my goodness. And it kind of like threw me into the whole loop of like, well, I don't know as much about this as I thought I did. And made me feel, you know, I guess that could be in a way of like me going back to my junior level and having to learn something over again. But I don't know. I guess the only way I can really make the separation or distinction in my mind is does this person know enough to get unstuck? Or does this person know enough to be able to put a picture together that's not fully formed? And I've worked with developers that haven't been able to do that, where if I didn't spill everything out completely, they weren't able to make any progress on it, versus some developers that were newer, didn't have a ton of experience, but I was able to put, you know, this is what I need done. And they're able to kind of like put the pieces in the middle together, I guess. That's maybe where the distinction lies for me. But yeah, this last week I've been feeling pretty, I have so much to learn.
Well, that's okay. There's always more to learn, right? Anyway, I don't want to belabor that point, that was just something that stood out for me. Other than that, like I said, I really enjoyed hearing you talk to Drew and hear about all, like, I learned more about the meta world of tattoo artists than I ever thought I would know. So,
yeah. So you said you were trying to work on some stuff while you were on vacation. What were you thinking about?
Yeah, so I had this idea kicking around about pipelines in applications. Because in our Phoenix application world, we've got plug, right? And you've got a router. And every request that comes in goes through plug. And plug has a pipeline. And pipelines are just little callback functions that get called one after another. And you've got this con object, and you're accumulating values on the object. It's basically like a reduce function, right? A request comes in, you reduce a bunch of stuff, and then you spit out a single response using all just that single con object. And that's like such a great model for the request response model for web servers, more or less, right? And I was thinking, like, okay, why you got the pipeline and it calls into your controller and your controller calls into your context function or whatever, but at that point your pipeline sort of stops. And there's a lot of great attributes of pipelines that lend themselves to that, just make them powerful, you know, reusability, composability, readability, right? Being able to break things down into individual steps, force you to think about like how the flow of your data goes through your application. And so I was like, okay, what if the pipeline from plug sort of seamlessly continued straight into your application, except now your application doesn't care about cons, it doesn't care about IP addresses or requests or routes or anything. It just cares about your application's own logic. And so I was like, okay, what if I took this to logical extreme and like literally designed, you know, thought about what an application would look like if you built it using those steps. And the short story is that I basically ended up re-implementing Sage, which is a hex package. I started down this road and I was like, oh, okay, it has to look like this, look like this. And then I was like, this kind of reminds me of something I've seen before. And sure enough, I went through the docks and it was like basically the same. And so I just kind of was like, okay, this is something that exists. I probably don't need to re-implement the wheel here. But the interesting thing was that the more I looked at it and the more I thought about it, and I didn't actually try implementing a real application this way, but I could see myself going down this path where the documentation, the README file for Sage, explains this really, really well. There's a rationale section. I'll link the README in the show notes here. It's on GitHub. And but my takeaway was that like this model of like doing things in this sort of transactional way works really, really well for some use cases, for some particular applications. Maybe you're dealing with a bunch of asynchronous third-party APIs. Maybe you are, doing some data processing or flow or something like that. Like all those things are really, really good fits for pipelines. But I'm not convinced that it's general purpose enough for like any application. You know, I don't think that taking your application's structure and forcing it into this box, more or less, is a big enough win for what you'd get out of it if it wasn't like a good fit to begin with.
You're coming for me now, aren't you?
What do you mean?
No, so when you say that, what was it? The discussion we had maybe a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about more opinionated solutions like Laravel on Rails, or I was looking around for something similar in the Phoenix world, like a sort of pre-built, here are all the rules you have to follow, and here's how we can scaffold an application. And you said something to the effect of maybe it's better that our applications or the Phoenix world isn't as general purpose, like suited for general purpose, right? You said maybe the implementation should be more specific and maybe that's better for the long run. And after you said that, I started thinking about the Phoenix readmes actually talk about this as well. And especially this was a big thing from Phoenix 1.2 to 1.3, introducing the idea of contexts. And that's something they wanted to do on purpose, was force this sort of step in choosing the patterns that you use and choosing the architecture or the shape of your application on purpose, instead of just kind of inheriting this, here's a system that works 80% of the time, right? And then inheriting that. So to me, it sounds very familiar when you say like Sage could work really well, or this idea of sagas or pipelines can work really well for a bunch of apps, but not all of them.
Or even a specific part of your app, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really interesting you brought that up, because you're totally right. I hadn't made that connection until you said it. And really, when you think about it, the 1.2 to 1.3 transition with context, right? Modules are just bags of functions. And so Phoenix decided on, hey, your unit of abstraction for your business logic, it's just a function, right?
Right.
And so that's what I came away with. I was like, why does it need to be more complicated than it is? Like, everyone understands functions. They're pretty good handlers for logic and effects, and you know, the immutability. You don't have to worry about side effects so much. I mean, you know, if you know what you're doing. So I kind of walked away with the feeling that I felt like I was maybe just trying too hard. So it was an interesting experience. Again, I didn't try to implement anything practically with this method, but it was a fun thought experiment.
I guess it's similar to the idea of metaprogramming Elixir, right? Like you can make all the macros you want, but you probably shouldn't in most cases, right? I'll find there's another discussion around this on Twitter. I'll have to look it up. Let me make a special note here. Find macro discussion on Twitter. So I follow a bunch of Elixir people. I have Elixir list on there, and they have some interesting discussions. It's a lot of people that work on like the core teams, like Core Elixir or Core Phoenix, and they have some interesting, thought-provoking discussions. And they were talking about macros recently. One person posited, this person I think was coming from outside of the Elixir ecosystem, but they are saying how the macro system is a sign of a poorly designed or a weakly designed language up front. So you have to put a macro system in to allow people to extend it in the way that they need to. Or
them's fighting words.
They were saying that, yeah, right. The macros were it's not, this isn't the words they use, but this is how it came across to me. But like macros were a cop out for a standard library that doesn't do enough.
So it's interesting because macros are so cool and they do so many powerful things, but every time I look at one, I get this gross feeling because it's, because they are by definition like non-standard. The language has a set of features and keywords that do certain things, and you're, and a lot of those features are built on macros themselves, right? Like if the if statement, it's just a macro. Have you ever looked at the source code for if?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's really cool. They talk about this a lot in the Elixir in Action book, how Elixir is only enough earling to get itself going, and then the rest of it's macros.
I mean, I think Elixir standard library is very, very good. It's very complete, but also very restrained, and things are named logically and can find things. I don't feel like it's doing too much, and the docs are great, of course. So I don't think that the language or the library itself are too limiting, because you really have to, as a language designer, I can't even imagine how difficult it must be to fight the urge to add features. Like, you have to resist that at every turn. And but yeah, like macros, it's tough because it's building on, you're building in some knowledge that looks like you have to know what it is already. You can't really, it's harder. Mm-hmm. It's harder to find the source of, because there's a level of indirection there. I mean, right. If you use it sparingly, it's probably fine, because how many crazy macros can you include in an application? Like three? Like, you're not going to have that many specific use cases for particular macros. Like, for example, in one of my projects, I use shorter maps. Have you seen that one?
Shorter maps. What is this? Shorter maps.
This is cool. So you know how it's very similar to how the way JavaScript can deconstruct objects.
Oh, no.
Right?
I like this.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, I thought about this a lot.
And the cool thing about this is that it's actually not really a macro. It's utilizing sigils, which sigils are a specific language feature that are very easy to spot. It's very clear that this is a sigil. It might not be clear what it's doing, but you know at least there's some magic going on here because of the syntax. But that's like one that I found very useful. It saves me a lot of typing. It makes the code easier to read, and it's really not that complicated what it's doing, especially if you're coming from, you know, a JavaScript background where you're familiar with object deconstruction.
Yeah, this is neat. Yeah, I like this. This is interesting. I've kind of tried to not pull stuff like this in as much as I can, and that's just because I'm trying to force myself to go deeper in Elixir, maybe. That's maybe a bad example or a bad reason why I haven't pulled something like this that could probably save me time in, but I've been trying to keep it as vanilla as possible. I'm trying to keep, as much as I can, I'm trying to keep Design Collective, Postgres, Elixir, and Elasticsearch. And I've succeeded in getting rid of my Redis dependency this last week, but this is interesting. I might have to pull this in and see how it feels. I don't know. See how it goes. But to your point earlier, you said you keep saying this to me over like every single week. You make some allude to just functions all the way down, just functions, right? It's just easier. And I was actually talking to a friend of the show, Nick, this week, and I was talking about why I feel so productive with Elixir and Design Collective. And one of the things I wanted to mention was this week I felt like I was struggling with design, like code design or code in like module design consistency, because DK is sort of all over the map. You can go into specific contexts and it's like, oh, this hasn't been touched in a year, or like it has a different style. Like a good example is workers. So some workers are modules, like product.worker, and some modules implement the perform callback right in the module, so it's not consistent. But even though things aren't consistent, it's so easy for me to get around, even if I haven't looked at code in a while, because it is just functions. I just command B myself way through the code, and I find what I'm looking for, and it's still just easy to refactor after all this time.
Yeah, and I don't want to get on the Ruby hate train, but I mean, the number of times I've dug into the Rails source code is effectively zero, because it's inscrutable if you don't know all the implicit state and everything that's going on. But the number of times I've dug into Phoenix or Ecto or Elixir or even the the Elixir Standard Library, it's a lot. A lot. And it's all in your depths folder right there. Like you can I don't even exclude it in Sublime when I'm doing my global searches. I include my depths folder because I want to see all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so tell me a little bit more about this. You've got this code style consistency thing. What's going on over there? You're looking at doing some refactoring, or are you just kind of taking a lay of the land?
Yeah, just, I mean, I'm sort of refactoring. So I'm moving away from XQ as my job queue. And XQ just is Redis. I think it's a Sidekick compatible Redis library or job library for Elixir. And I found another library called Oban that's actually really cool. It's a PG-backed store, Oban Elixir. And I've never had a job queue system that wasn't backed by Redis before. So this was new to me. But as I was saying, I'm trying to keep things as simple as possible. And I started looking around, and the only thing we're using Redis for is for jobs, and there's not a real technical reason why we need to stay on Redis for those jobs. I mean, we don't have an obscene scale where Postgres wouldn't be able to handle it, for example. So I thought to myself, why not jump back over and check out Oban and implement that? So I made a new branch. And as I was sort of refactoring away the XQ workers into Oban workers, I was like, oh, I'm not really following a pattern here. Really, the only pattern with XQ or Oban is that you need to have a module designated as a worker, and that module just has to have a perform callback function. That's it. So you could enqueue a job and perform the job in the same module. It doesn't matter. And I noticed that I was sort of doing that in some places. In other places, I had a specific worker module set aside for it. But that's really all it is. It's just not like a consistent way of like, oh, I have a workers folder and all the workers are in there and they look the same sort of thing. It's sort of like I need a job to run here, so I'm just going to toss it here really quick. So I think a lot of it's just a product of being busy and being in a hurry and being in a rush and not thinking to myself, oh, I should have a folder where all these go so they're easier to find. But that's really it. It has nothing to do with the ability to get around or the ability to be able to figure out how something works, I don't think. But it's more so a lack of like, this module does it this way, this module over here does it that way. It's not causing any bugs or issues. Maybe it cost me a few extra minutes to figure out what's happening in the module, but that's it.
So did you end up deciding on a particular pattern or structure or something?
No.
Okay.
I just replaced them in place.
All right. That's fine. I mean, I find myself doing that a lot with any kind of callback. It's like sometimes I just want to do it in line because that's the only place I really care about looking at it. Like it's some kind of, particularly with JavaScript and you're wiring up event emitters, handlers, basically. Like sometimes you just want it to be in line because... again, like you don't need any other context of the rest of the application. You don't need a function or method, I guess, to exist just to like be a callback and have it called nowhere else, right? You can do that,
yeah.
But especially if it's called in multiple places, obviously you want that to be the case. You don't want to be copying and pasting. But I mean the inline callbacks are, you know, basically like you said, implementing perform on the same module that enqueues it. Probably fine. Yeah. It might be a little harder to locate. Yeah. You know, like you said, a folder full of workers is pretty clear what's going on there. But
right,
yeah, I don't know.
Most of those workers would just have one function, one callback function in them. That's mostly what happens right now. It's just a single callback function. And really, the stuff I've had to do job wise is like sending emails or sending an email to this list or simple stuff like that. I haven't really had a whole lot of other things. And so it's just like, so for example, we send a couple of weekly digests, and one digest is so if you follow a store design collective, you'll get their digest store, their store digest, unless you've opted out of it. And it's basically just their latest inventory and stuff. And so we have a marketplace.stores.weeklydigest module. And if you run marketplace.stores.weeklydigest.enqueue, it enqueues all the jobs and then in the same module, it just performs them as well. And that's typically in Design Collective how all of those are set up. It's the specific sort of thing that would trigger the jobs is its own thing anyway. So it sort of makes sense to keep them there. But that was sort of mildly annoying to me, maybe, was that it wasn't... I like to have things consistent. I like to have things clean, for example. Like recently, we were in the Discord and people were sharing pictures of their desk and they were stressing me out because stuff was everywhere. And I don't know. So really, like, the only consequence was, again, I think I said like 5 extra minutes to understand how something worked. And then the mild level of stress it caused me to look at it and know that they weren't the same.
What it comes down to is this friction between organizing your code, and really what I'm talking about organizing like files and folders, right? Is organizing either by what it is or by what it does, right? The way we're used to organizing things is by what they are. You got a folder of controllers, a folder of views, a folder of context, a folder of schemas, a folder of, migrations, right? It's like you're organizing it by the type of the thing. Whereas another way to think about it is you want to organize it by what it's doing. What's the logical operation of this set of things, right? Maybe all the views, controllers, and contexts for the marketplace browse live in one folder, and then you walk up the tree, and then there's a whole same substructure for admins and another thing for whatever, and workers and stuff. And so I always feel that friction because it feels like when things are organized by their type, you're doing a lot of jumping around. It's a lot of open tabs, a lot of folders. They're flat, generally flat folder structures, which are just, once things start to get big, it's hard to kind of keep track of. And especially when things are alphabetical, it's like they're not really even grouped by anything meaningful. Like you have 2 files that you're staring at that have nothing to do with each other. Yeah. I did a little hacking one time on, did I do it on RHR? I'm looking at my web config here.
I know exactly. I was going to bring this up too, because
yeah,
you did a you said you did a little hacking and you made, was this pre Phoenix 1.3? Was it Phoenix 1.2 that you did this on?
I don't recall. I'm pulling it up here though. I'll put this in the show notes because it's actually pretty cool how I was even able to get this done. But basically, I reorganized the whole Phoenix structure to be the second way I describe things, the group it by type, group it by concept, not by type. You basically just overwrite the Phoenix view thing so it knows where to look for the templates, and that was pretty much the only thing I had to change.
Oh, in web, let's see, DK. I actually have DK code up right now. DK web. I remember you. I think I tried this. Yeah. So in the view macro, you use phoenix.view root, and you just tell it where the templates live.
Yeah, and exactly. It takes a string. Yeah, because everything else, that's folder, it doesn't matter.
Right. So I will say that I've actually been working on a couple of just fun apps on the side. I'm messing around with Live View a little bit. And the only thing that's a little bit annoying to me is how the magic works with Phoenix in terms of views and templates, or not the magic, but the dance you have to do. That's maybe the only thing where I'm like, I can take it or leave it how it's done right now. But it's been sort of refreshing to like, so for example, one thing I'm doing is rebuilding Bthink, but it's just a traditional server-side app. And then I was planning on adding the ability to search for your notifications using Live View. It's pretty easy, quick example to wrap my head around Live View. And it's been sort of refreshing to, I don't know, just have a controller and you just pass it data and then it's just a view that's rendered. You don't have to worry about API endpoints or GraphQL, your GraphQL endpoint, and then jump over to another project and spin that up and making requests and stuff. It's nice. I mean, Imagine that. I think like for a larger, like I couldn't imagine building DK as it is right now, I think would still be significantly harder if it weren't split into API client and front end, or back end and front end. But yeah, for simple stuff, man, it's just nice.
So I had another thing that was kicking around in my head that I ran into the other day, and this is tangentially related to your job workers, in terms of naming the job or naming an asynchronous thing. And actually, I think this almost actually directly applies, right? So you've got some event, right? Something that you need to perform asynchronously. and you need to tell the world that this thing needs to be performed, right? So in your case, it's like your job, worker, class name, right? When you name that thing, how do you... I'm having trouble forming the words for this. Do you name it by the cause, as in like what the event was raised that caused the thing to happen? Or do you name it by the effect in the sense of what you want the thing to do? And like the best example I could think of was like UI events, right? UI events are very much named after the cause, right? Mouse click, key down, key press, mouse move, whatever. UI events, because they don't really know what you're doing, are always named after the cause, the original emitter, the origin of the event. But you always, really what you end up doing is binding them to functions that tell you what you want to do. Oh, mouse click, turn button blue, right? So again, there's this friction between like, how do you gotta name those things where it's like there's this business logic kind of implied. And my particular example was, okay, I have a client, it's connected to a server via like a TCP connection. What's the event raise that I need to perform some like steps after initialization? Do I call it connected or authenticated? Like as like, hey, this thing occurred, it's up to you to decide what to do. Or do I say like, hey, perform initial checks or something like that, right?
Right. So it's like the difference between putting sort of like, so it's like the difference between, you know, if you're emitting event like connected, you're sort of removing the business events from whatever is emitting that, if it's on the front end, right? So if you're in like a view component or whatever, you're emitting event, you're removing any knowledge of what actually is happening versus if you say emitting event like, what do you say, initial connect or something like that,
or perform checks or yeah.
So then the thing that's emitting at that point actually by virtue of name only, or like naming this event only, knows that, hey, the backend has to perform its initial checks here.
But I guess it's not really the name that bothered me so much, but it's the sense that, okay, if you're going to refactor it or move something or change something, suddenly you have to decide, like, if the thing's called perform initial checks, like, you as the consumer of that event or the implementer, like, you don't really care when that occurs, right? Maybe you don't know the underlying, like, you don't even know that you're a TCP connection, because like, what if you're doing it over polling or WebRTC, like, or something that doesn't, UDP doesn't even have a concept of connection, right? But you still need to perform that callback, maybe. So like, you might be calling it from multiple places or different places. Like, I guess it's not so much the consistency I worry about. It's more like the, I don't know. Maybe it is really consistency, actually, when I think about it. Like, I want it to be the same. I want to use the same rule set, but I have trouble coming up with that rule set.
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. Is this sort of similar to what we were talking about the other day with you were dumping code into a Notion doc that you shared with me, and we were talking about the structure of, I think it was a gen server. You were handling, you're basically implementing callback functions, right, for something, and we were trying to figure out, do we want, was it the session or a socket or something similar to come first or last?
Right. Right. That's such a minor thing to worry about. But this keeps me up at night, man.
Yeah. Well, so for example, like looking at LiveView, I think this is what I kept talking about, was looking at how LiveView did it, or I think you mentioned Gen Server too, like, because I haven't jumped into those much at all. But with LiveView, you have a function like handle event, and then I should probably pull this up really quick to make sure that I'm not making it up. Of Phoenix, LiveView, Elixir.
Let's listen to Sean navigate the web.
Yeah, so the handle event function, it's three arity, and the first position is the event that happens. So if you're looking at elixirschool.com and they have a blog post about Phoenix LiveView, one of the events is called GitHub deploy. And then the second argument is you're taking a value, and the third argument, you're taking a socket, which seems the opposite of like a Phoenix controller, right? Like that plug setup, because with plug, the con's always first, so you can pipe it. I think that's what we were talking about. Like, does it matter if socket is first so you can pipe things through it? Would you ever want to do that? In this case, with Phoenix LiveView, it's last, right?
Right, because it's a callback. It's not really inherently a piping operation. And I feel like Phoenix socket or Phoenix LiveView did that just to mimic the Gen Server callbacks, which the Gen Server callbacks are rooted in, you know, God knows what Erlang, you know, thing from the 80s. So, like, who knows what their logic was for doing it.
Yeah, that's interesting. So when you mentioned that consistency, that was something I was going to mention earlier, was that the only sense of consistency that I have when Design Collective's code style are the rules that Phoenix taught me or things that Ecto taught me, for example, like Ecto Multi or using change sets for data validations, right? Beyond that, it's just a free-for-all. but that was one thing I specifically noticed, though, was the things that are consistent are things that I've been instructed to do a certain way, whether it's change sets, validating data through change sets, or stringing together multiple operations that need to be in a single transaction with Ecto Multi, for example. It's that. I guess that's what I'm trying to say is, like, that's where I look for how to do something. Like, that's what I look for patterns, is the tools that I'm using and the things that sort of are baked in, I suppose. And thinking about Phoenix, what's baked in with Phoenix, I guess Ecto, I mean, you can turn it off, right? But by default, you have that in there. There's not much else, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good thing. I mean, I guess I hadn't really considered, like, prior art is pretty powerful. I mean, you got to assume that people smarter than you have already figured this problem out. Maybe they haven't. Yeah. Maybe they messed up, but, like, at least you have something to look at, and sometimes it's hard finding analogs for what you're working on that already exist, because you might be working on something new or different. But if you look at the higher level concepts, I'm sure you could find something out there that matches what you're trying to do. It's a really good point.
Yeah, I think I like a lot what you said about prior art, having something to look at. I think a lot of that comes down to me not necessarily, again, feeling like a senior developer, like trusting myself, right? So I'm always looking elsewhere for rules to follow, CNUX, CLaravel, CRails, whatever. And I was actually having a discussion with friend of the show, Brian. He was on a few weeks ago, but he messaged me. He's like, so what, you know, like, what kind of things that would you want to implement in Elixir from Laravel land, you know? And we got to talking, and I think really he helped me figure out that, again, what I'm looking for is just more rules and more prior art, I suppose, that I can fall back on. And Elixir and Phoenix are more towards a spectrum where Node, where you kind of piecemeal things together that you need when you need it. And obviously Rails and Laravel being the other side, where you sort of have most everything you need there, and you just reach for it. You don't have to reach for an external source or a third-party source. And I think a lot of that stems from me wanting prior art, or wanting to, like, a decision made for me. What job queue do I use, for example, you know? I don't know why I hadn't connected those two points. When you said that word prior art to fall back onto, that really, like, set the light bulb off of my head, I guess. But it's been an interesting few weeks thinking about, I think you really kicked it off for me when you said, like, should things be more generalized, or should they be more specific? And then again, as I mentioned, I started thinking about the Phoenix documentation, where, like, we're intentionally choosing context, so you have to make some choices up front. You have to make these choices. We can't make them for you, basically. And then I think it was last week I was talking with a friend of the show, Dan. He makes POW, and we were basically talking about, you know, like, why isn't there an official devise for Elixir or Phoenix, for example, right? And he sort of said the same thing. Like, he thinks that the use cases, you know, beyond the first 80%, that's where the whole 20% lies, and that's where the real issue comes in, is the library is not ultra flexible, then you get kind of stuck and you're going to have to re-implement it anyway, you know? So why not have the tools that we have now, POW I don't know how to pronounce it, Photh, PHXAUTH is another solution. Why not use those? Because, you know, they get you close, but they're not coming with all of these baked in assumptions, I guess, that you have to sort of override. And it goes back to the point you're talking about, you know, configuration via functions versus configuration via config, right? The latter is much easier to scale and build upon.
You mean the former? The fun-
yeah, the former, okay. Sorry. Not the latter, the former. Yes, correct.
And yeah, going back to what you just said, like, I was hemming hung about argument positions, whether this, you know, this state object should be the first argument or the last argument. And the more I stared at it, the more I ended up just re-implementing or mocking what gen server callbacks look like, because that's what I'm most comfortable with. That's what I'm most familiar with. That's what people, I feel like people would know and understand and immediately connect to and sort of draw those connections, even if it's a different concept, where you have the sort of accumulated state as the last argument of your callback. Handle info, handle cast, handle call. All the WebSocket channel callbacks, the socket, which is more or less your gen server state, that's at the end. It has certain benefits. It improves readability a little bit, but like you said, you can't pipe it. Anyway, I'm getting in the weeds here, but the point is that, like you said, just going with what I was familiar with in terms of structure, I think is a big benefit.
Yeah, yeah. And I've been trying to like really dive more into Elixir and put myself out there and talk to people more. So for example, like, I've mentioned him a couple of times, but friend of the show, Dan, he made POW. I had some questions. So I shot him a DM on Twitter and was like, hey, how about this, this, and this? And he answered them, you know? So, I think in implementing POW into Design Collective, I learned quite a few things, about, you know, designing something that's flexible that can be overridden relatively easily. You know, I learned a lot of security things. I learned a lot about Amnesia, even looking at his PR, because he's working on adding a distributed Amnesia cache for it. So that way your token store and your session store is just distributed by default, which would be pretty cool, depending on, I guess, how you're hosting it. We can't use that at DK, but... still kind of cool. But yeah, just like jumping in and again, looking at
now that Redis is gone.
Well, I mean, we could, so he has an example in the repo that you could basically, so there's a behavior, I think it's called pow.session.store, I think it's something.store. And all you have to do is implement the behavior. So I actually made a couple of custom Ecto stores myself, cause we were already storing stuff in the database, because that's how Coherence was doing it. But I could put Redis back in and store our sessions there. And then I would have a distributed, store for my dynos. But I learned a lot by, it seems so simple, right? Just like reading code and asking questions. I'm trying to do that more. Again, I am sticking to my, I think I mentioned it a few weeks ago, but my schedule where I wake up, and first thing I do is I read and take notes on a book. And I've been reading through Phoenix in Action and Elixir in Action recently, taking notes on those. But also some mornings I'll just pull up a GitHub repository and just look at stuff.
That's cool, man. And you're also punching things in the morning now.
Yeah, I started training in the morning. It's weird.
It'll wake you up.
It's weird. It's funny because... I don't want to drink a ton of coffee before working out because it's a diuretic. So I'm drinking coffee on the way, and I'm standing in the gym, and the instructor comes in and he's holding a mug. He was like driving with a mug of coffee.
Just a plain mug, ceramic mug.
Just a plain mug. Yeah, just a ceramic mug. I started training in the mornings. It's weird, definitely weird. Waking up, what I think. Class is at 8, so I get up at 6:30 and read for a while, and then I leave the house by 7:40, get to class and train, come home, and I start working around 10, I think, has been the new schedule.
That was the thing my dad always did, was driving with the freaking ceramic mug of coffee, and like he had one of those like Chevy vans where like the front of the like there's no carpet or anything, it's just a rubber mat seat, so like he would always spill it, and it just always perpetually smelled like coffee because he's always spilling it. Like, what do you expect? What do you think was going to happen?
Right. Yeah, it would be bad. I mean, I don't wear my gi in the car, but if I did spill it, it's in my bag next to me, and I wouldn't have a brown and white gi, which would be not awesome.
You get a brown belt. But,
yeah, that'd be bad too. They're like, what are you doing with that? You didn't earn that belt. You'd probably get beat up or something. I've never actually seen anyone try to add a stripe to themselves, like on the sly. I don't know what would happen.
Oh man, that's I feel like there's, yeah, you'd get called out pretty quick.
I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, I started training at a new gym cause I moved back to California, and I had a few stripes on my belt. So you walk in and everyone was like, did he actually earn those stripes? I think most people...
Do you have to start over?
No. I think most people give you the benefit of a doubt, but they don't know what your actual skill level is, because three stripes could mean totally different things depending on the person.
Or the wherever you trained, right? Could be totally different levels.
Exactly. Like if you see a person playing guitar on the street before hearing them, you don't know, you know what I mean? Like they could be good, they could be bad. You don't know. They have a guitar though. So there's not like an indicator being able to tell, you know, what a person's skill level is without actually training with them and seeing how they train and what the, you know, what their strengths and weaknesses are. So everyone's kind of like sussing you out for the first few weeks.
I think we've come full circle to the junior developer discussion at the top of the show.
There we go.
Circle's complete.
The circle is complete. Yeah, I like your point there about the junior stuff. I don't know. I think it depends. As always, the answer is it depends.
Trademark.
Depends on many things. Yeah. Welp. If anyone has any feedback or anything they'd like to say or any reason to call me out on Twitter, please do. I appreciate all feedback, all forms of feedback. And we appreciate any shares. We appreciate any rates on iTunes. We just like interacting with you all. So please reach out to us if you have some time.
One way you can do that is on Twitter. The show Twitter is DNC Show. Sean is Sean Washbot. And I am Shrockwell.
And as always, everything we talked about today, we put in the show notes. So links to GitHub repos and things like that. And those will be available at dnc.show.
We'll also post the show notes over on spectrum.chat where you can come chat with us, come say hi, have any discussions, and see what we've got cooking up over there.
And as always, thanks to Spec for having us. And if you're interested in other design and development related shows, you should definitely head on over to spec.fm and check out the shows we've got going on there. So we've got shows like Design Details and Swift Unwrapped and Fragmented. So if you need some more time to fill, then you should definitely head on over to spec.fm and check out some more podcasts.
And quick plug before we go, if you're still listening, I should have done this earlier when people are paying attention, but Sean and I will both be at ElixirConf in Aurora, Colorado. So we're going to have some sweet, sweet DNC stickers. They're a limited edition run, and you can get them, collector's items. Once you get them, once they run out, they're gone. So grab some stickers, come see us, say hi. And I'm really looking forward to hanging out with all the Elixir devs and rafting down that lazy river.
Yeah, I've never been to a conference, a tech conference before, so it's been my first one.
I'm so
looking forward to it.
I'm so excited for you.
All of my Elixir friends except for Dave will be there. Shout out to Dave. Hey Dave, hope you're doing well.
This episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson.
Well, I have to run to the store, so gotta make some sweet, sweet mac and cheese.
Oh, man. Homemade?
Homemade, yeah. So I was watching Friends, and then I came across the episode where Joey had to show mac and cheese.
So what's
and
your...
I need to have some mac and cheese now.
What's your mac and cheese look like? Because there's a lot of different ways to make mac and cheese.
Crumblies on top, maybe some jalapenos in there.
Nice.
Use a little bit of condensed milk to get this cheese, like, sort of soupy. Not too wet, mind you. So my perfect mac and cheese is a bowl of mac and cheese from... Noodles and Company.
Okay. I don't think I've had that.
Which is a chain. You probably haven't.
I've seen it. I think it's a West Coast thing, right?
I used to eat there in Minnesota, actually. Noodles. Menu. Wisconsin mac and cheese. That's what it was called. Ooh, here we go. Here's a picture. I'll put this in the show notes, too. Where are you at? Here.
I had to make mac and cheese for a party barbecue last weekend. And we use this recipe where you basically... You use like a whole block of sharp cheddar, right? And you melt it in the pot with the milk and the flour and all that stuff. And then you also add like an entire packet of American cheese slices. You just kind of rip them up and just kind of melt them in there. And like, it's such a weird thing, but it gives it a nice orange color. And it's just something about the flavor. Like, I know it's not real cheese, but it gives a little extra something.
Yeah, Jamie wouldn't let me use American cheese.
No.
She's anti-American cheese.
That's objectively the right choice, but I'm just saying, it's an option.
Yeah. I guess my perfect mac and cheese is a creamy mac and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
That's and it has a little crunch on it, maybe some breadcrumb.
Yeah, the bread the breadcrumbs with the butter. Ugh.
And you broil it. You broil it in the oven a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I overdid it one time and it came out black.
Oh, so last thing before I gotta go. Did you know? I don't know if you'd want to drive there, but in New Hampshire, by nearish the airport in the small airport near what do they call it? What's the town in New Hampshire?
Winnipesaukee.
They call it something Vegas.
Manch Vegas.
Manch Vegas. Manchester, that's it.
Wait, I sorry, I just love the fact that you're the literal only other person I know who knows who's called it Manch Vegas.
Manch Vegas. I've never said that before. I've heard people say it.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I couldn't remember Manchester.
That's amazing. But my friend lives there and she hates it when I call it that. She hates it.
Manch Vegas.
Ugh.
Well, did you know that there's a mac and cheese store, restaurant that you can go to, and they just cook mac and cheese in a skillet, and you just walk and sit down with a skillet and eat mac and cheese, and they have a jalapeno popper mac and cheese.
Why you say this? Why you do this to me?
It's probably worth a trip to Manch Vegas.
I could fly up there.
Probably. All right, I gotta run. Just gotta make some mac and cheese. All right, see ya.
See ya.